just one word changed. I think they changed the word from sex is life to sex is good. But even though very few people would admit to the extreme version of that ad, this version, our culture certainly seems to put sex near the top, if not at the top, of the list of what is important in life. And Solomon seems to have had through a phase, at least a pretty long phase, when he seems to have felt that way. Now, sex is good, but what does wealth have to do with sex? Well, as I said in the lesson a week before last, Ecclesiastes boils down to these three categories: wealth, wisdom, and work. And all of life's physical pleasures fit into the wealth category, because the wealthier you are, the more opportunities you usually have to enjoy those physical pleasures. But we all have some wealth, and as Americans, we have more wealth than over 99% of the people in this world. That's the truth. Even if we're not rich in America, we're richer than 99% of the people in the world. And even if we're not in the top 1% of in America, you know, we're in that 1% when it comes to all of humanity. But even most of those who are not anywhere near close to the top, and may even be what we would consider impoverished, they still have choices. Everyone has choices when it comes to physical pleasures. Almost everyone has some opportunities to enjoy food, to enjoy sex, to enjoy music, to enjoy beauty, and other pleasures that involve our physical senses. So that's what wealth is all about. Well, Solomon had a lot more than most when it comes to that. But let's review how Solomon came to be wealthy. Back in 1 Kings, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream. And God said, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." This is when Solomon had just become king. Solomon answered, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day." He's talking about himself. "Now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I'm only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you have asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both wealth and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in obedience to me and keep my decrees and commands as your father, as David your father did, I will give you a long life." Okay, so Solomon grew wise, but he also grew very wealthy. And wealth is a sort of catch-all for the physical realm. With wealth, we are able to have pleasures and things that bring us pleasure. All right? So work and wisdom and wealth are meant to be enjoyed by those who have turned their lives over to God. And those are the categories that Solomon examines in Ecclesiastes. Okay, so today we'll look a little more deeply at wealth. We sort of started into that. But the truth is that internals are what God wants us to value, but God wants us also to enjoy the pleasures that wealth brings. So, however, there is a caveat, and that is that without God, wealth is meaningless. So let's read his words in Ecclesiastes. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I'm not sure how that worked. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except to feast their eyes on them? Okay. Now, look at chapter 5. Where did we go? Okay, no, never mind. Without God, wealth is meaningless. This is the frustrating thing about wealth and the pleasures it can buy. You work so hard to get the things that you never take time to enjoy them. And so you begin to take pleasure in acquiring, in getting things, and even getting people. And then once you get them, you know, maybe you do little with them. We become like dogs chasing cars. You know, there was an anecdote in Reader's Digest, and it's kind of crept its way into the vernacular, I've noticed. But it was sent in originally, I think, by someone who watched a dog chasing a little convertible down the street when all of a sudden the driver stopped the car and said to the dog, "So, you've caught it. What are you going to do with it?" Mm-hmm. Well, what interest does a dog have in a car? Is he planning to eat it? Well, you know, bury it? Like a bone, drive it? What? Well, the dog cannot enjoy having a car. He just enjoys chasing it. If he ever gets it, then the fun's over. My nephew, just this last week, he's in Northwest Arkansas, and he has two little girls. How old are they? 2 and 4. And just last week, he took his two little girls fishing for the first time on Father's Day. And they loved it, and he loved it. So Brenda asked, well, if they caught anything. He said, nope. It wasn't about catching. It was about fishing. And people back when I was in Montana, you know, you had to hunt. It was a part of the culture. And so they'd ask me if I enjoyed hunting. And I'd tell them, no, I only enjoy finding. Well, you know, what's to enjoy about getting up at 4 a.m. and carrying, you know, a heavy gun around in 0-degree weather on steep mountains? You know, I enjoyed seeing the game if we ever saw it. I enjoyed bagging it if we ever got it, you know, eating it even, maybe even having a nice mount to enjoy. And so all of that and the fellowship may have made it worth the hunt, but the hunt was not the fun part to me. But there were a lot of hunters and fishermen in Montana who didn't eat the meat or the fish. A lot of fishermen did the catch and release thing. You know, once I went fishing on a stream in Idaho, a river in Idaho, actually, where you were not allowed to keep the fish. It was all catch and release. You had to have barbless hooks so that you didn't injure the fish when you took it out of their mouth and put it back in the river. So it was not really about really doing it to survive. It was about the idea that you could live off the land if you had to, you know. So it was the pursuit of that dream. Well, have you noticed that as Americans, you know, we have tend to have nicer and nicer homes, but we might spend less and less time in them. Sometimes we'll get the best sports equipment, you know, and then take very little time to enjoy or master the sport. Or we'll watch our diet and exercise so that we can live longer, but then we don't enjoy the extra time that buys us. You know, we just prolong the misery. So we'll pursue that beautiful girl and we'll romance her, and then we win her only to neglect her once we're married. You know, so why do people do these kinds of things? Well, if we pay attention, we find that pleasure for the sake of pleasure becomes empty very quickly. There has to be something more. And so maybe we just begin to pursue and pursue so that we don't think about that. But our friend in Washington, Jack Frost, that was really his name, Jack Frost, but he was a builder of beautiful custom log homes. And he was amazed, though, to see about half of the families that he built homes for would break up once the house was built. And I think I know why. Well, you know, I mean, there's considerable stress in the process of making all the decisions when you build a house, and there's also financial stress, but I don't think that that's all there is to it. I think that they may have been counting on this American dream to make them happy. And so this beautiful new house was supposed to give them a beautiful new life or make their life more beautiful. But, you know, as we know, a house is only an accessory to a home. A house is not a home. It's a box. You know, no matter how nicely it's packaged, it remains a box. But you can enjoy having that box. You can enjoy it a lot when you see it as a means to an end rather than an end in itself. There's a problem with debt in America, you may have noticed, maybe in your own life, and there's a movement against it. Dave Ramsey is one guy who leads a movement to advise families to live on rice and beans for one meal, and then for variety, beans and rice the next. And he says you should never see the inside of a restaurant unless you're moonlighting in that restaurant so you can use the money to pay off that debt that you have. And he doesn't want people, though, to do that forever. He says that you live like no one else lives in America and save up money to buy everything with cash except for your house, and then you pay that house off maybe 10 years. And so that requires some self-discipline and self-denial. But what is the net result of being debt-free is more important. He says, once you're debt-free, then you can rely, you can enjoy a lifestyle without worry, and you can live like no one else in America in a different way, because you aren't controlled by your debt. Everything doesn't revolve around money, around your debt. Well, that's not something that most of us will actually go all the way on and do, but we can all make wiser choices and avoid being controlled by debt and financial concerns. And that can be the key to a greater enjoyment of everything, from music, art, food, cars, houses, sports, even sex and marriage. The more we are controlled by a desire for those things, the less that we tend to enjoy them. We can only enjoy them fully when we assign them to their proper place and recognize them as what they are. What are they? What are our physical pleasures? What are all of the things that we enjoy? They are gifts of God. So without God, wealth is meaningless, but with God, wealth has meaning. As long as we recognize all of the things that come from our wealth as gifts from God. So let's turn to the first positive sounding verses in Ecclesiastes. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after
slavery. Wealth. You guys are supporting slavery by looking at this shit and not saying something.
Okay, so there is a time for everything except for that. But no, there is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones, and a time to gather them, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search, and a time to give up. A time to keep, and a time to throw away. A time to tear, and a time to mend. A time to be silent, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. That's a key reality. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Eternity in the human heart is the one thing that isn't included in work, wisdom, and wealth. That's what makes us different. That's what makes all of what we do different. I know that there is nothing better for people than, once we realize this, to be happy and do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. Fear him, he means respect him. So go on to chapter 5 again, where the picture of frustration is drawn. In verses 10 through 17, but that's not where it leaves off. Let's start at verse 3 of chapter 5. I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost through some misfortune so that when they have children, there's nothing left for them to inherit. This too is a grievous evil. As everyone comes, so they depart. And what do they gain since they toil for the wind? All their days they eat in darkness with great frustration, affliction, and anger. This is what I have observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them. For this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God. They seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. Okay, so, let's go on to chapter 8, look at verse 15. So I commend the enjoyment of life because there's nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. And then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of the life God has given them under the sun. All right, so we are despising God's gifts when we misuse them. But we should enjoy God's gifts. They were meant to be enjoyed. When we refuse pleasure, we are despising God's gifts. Do you remember the root meaning of the most commonly used Greek word for sin? You probably all know that. It's hamartia in Greek. Okay, yeah, you didn't know. But anyway, it means literally to miss the target. If we despise God's gifts, aren't we a little off target? If we call what is good evil, haven't we missed the mark? Pleasure is not evil. It is a sin to call pleasure evil. Pleasure is not the enemy. We're way off target when we attempt to draw closer to God by denying pleasure. You just missed my birthday yesterday. But I will accept late gifts. And I know that you'll probably all go out and sacrifice and put a lot of thought into going out to find just the right thing for me, and then you'll wrap it up and bring it to me, and you'll give it to me with bated breath, you know. You'll hardly be able to wait to see my expression and then to see me enjoy your gift on through the years. Oh, yeah. But how will you feel if I just look at the gift in its wrapping and break out in a cold sweat and get some tongs and carry it outside and burn it without even opening it? And then I tell you that I did that with your gift because I love you and want to be closer to you. Sometimes we do that with God's gifts. We refuse his pleasure and claim that it's because we love him. Well, yes, there's a danger in nice gifts. You know, what if you did give me, you know, a set of golf clubs and then I played golf with everyone but you? Or what if Brenda gave me a nice trip for two to Hawaii and I took Derek along instead of Brenda? You know, what if Ken gave me a nice little sports car, you know, but I never took him for a drive? You know, I wouldn't do that and take you for a drive. But anyway, you get the idea. If we shut God out while we are enjoying the pleasures that he has given us, there's something really wrong. Romans 1 talks about worshiping and serving the created things rather than the Creator. And that's what we're doing if we don't give thanks to God for the pleasures in life and actually enjoy them. Let's go on to the end of Ecclesiastes, where he puts it this way: you who are young, be happy while you are young, and let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Now, I don't take that as a play now, pay later. I think it's sincere advice. He says, follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but in ways that will bring a positive verdict or a positive judgment, things that you know that God is going to be pleased with. So we should do what we enjoy doing if it is a gift of God. Now, there are pleasures that we might attempt to steal. Those aren't gifts of God. In having sex outside of marriage, using alcohol or other drugs, gluttony, revenge, all of those can bring pleasure. Well, how do we know the difference between good pleasures and stolen pleasures? Well, if these pleasures are things that we can feel good about and share with God, you know, and say thank you, God, as we do them, then we can be pretty sure that they are gifts from him, you know, unless there is the possibility that we've allowed the enemy to twist our brain into believing that what is evil is good because it makes us feel good, you know. If it feels good, do it. Sometimes we can buy into that, but we should not feel guilty about the legitimate pleasures that he has given us. We shouldn't feel guilty about where we were born, even though we have it a lot better than many people in the world, we're very privileged. We shouldn't feel guilty about that. We shouldn't feel guilty about loving food. We shouldn't feel guilty about enjoying a laugh as long as it's not at someone else's expense. We shouldn't feel guilty about enjoying the beauty that surrounds us or enjoying the abundance of good people in our lives. Or enjoying intimacy with our husband or wife, or enjoying houses or cars and clothing. even art and decoration and fashion and football games and golf and biking and traveling, all these things are things that we enjoy, and we could feel guilty about it because so many people don't get to enjoy them, but none of those things are evil. And so, you know, we shouldn't be self-indulgent, but if we haven't stolen these pleasures, and if we give thanks to God as we enjoy them, if we do that, then the enjoyment of pleasure will strengthen our relationship with God. It won't pull us away from God. And if you're wondering, well, what about greed and selfishness? Well, there's no better way to overcome greed and selfishness than to really enjoy God's gifts that you have with a thankful heart. We won't want more, more, more. We'll actually want to share the joy with others. We'll not feel so inclined to be possessive. So here's a question that that should settle the issue. Did Jesus do anything fun or pleasurable? Look at Luke 7. Jesus went on to say, "To what then can I compare the people of this generation? What are they like? They're like children sitting in the marketplace and calling out to each other." This doesn't come out in most versions, but it's actually two groups of children calling out to each other. One saying, "We played the pipe for you and you did not dance." And the other group saying, "We sang a dirge and you did not cry." For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine. John ate locusts out in the wilderness, remember? And you say, he has a demon. See, he's not enjoying anything. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say he's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. We can be sure that Jesus was not a glutton and a drunkard, but we can also be sure that he did enjoy eating and drinking together with friends, and even with strangers for that matter. You know, he tells Zacchaeus, "I'm coming to your house, we're gonna party." You know? And so we need to not seek wealth and pleasure. It's a gift of God. It's not something that we should seek. So it's the pursuit, not the possession of wealth, that is meaningless. And so when we enjoy those things as gifts from God, all pleasures have meaning. So we should not pursue pleasure. I don't believe that Jesus did that, but we should not deny or refuse pleasure, because I know Jesus didn't do that. He was criticized for it by some who did deny themselves pleasure in the idea that they were more holy because they fasted. So here's our homework. Make a pleasure inventory of your own pleasures. List every pleasure in your life, everything you really enjoy. Identify any stolen pleasures, anything that you really aren't really legitimate for you, and ask for God's help to clear them out of your life. But then thank God for all of the legitimate pleasures and enjoy them even more as gifts from God. Faux God? Anyway, sorry. Okay, let's pray together. Our Father.